Mooney on RTE Radio 1 with Flora Proactive. Switching to Flora Proactive can help lower your cholesterol.
Visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Now, about one third of the carbon dioxide released since the Industrial Revolution has dissolved into the oceans where it forms carbonic acid. And yet, we hear very little about the effects of ocean acidification on the ocean's inhabitants. The Royal Research Ship RRS James Cook will set sail from Glasgow on a changing oceans expedition next month, and marine biologist Roan Byrne will be on board taking part in the research. Roan is in the studio with us now. Roan, tell us all about this.
Certainly, Derek. Afternoon, folks. This is a Heriot Watt University chartered vessel to go out to the North Atlantic and sample sites that were sampled 30 to 40 years ago and test deep water corals, Lophelia species, down to 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 metres down, and look for the effects of ocean acidification. And it has, on board, it has pilots from the Marine Institute who'll be operating the robotics and the remote operated vehicles, and we'll be doing research on many different facets in the ocean, these deep areas which are normally inaccessible to humans, getting high definition images and data and information, and seeing if ocean acidification has accelerated over the last 20, 30, 40 years and what effect it has in the marine environment.
Well, what effect do you think it's having?
It's having a colossal effect, Derek. Would you believe a recent paper in Science, in the journal Science, stated this year that ocean acidification has increased faster over the last 30 to 50 years than in the last 300 million years. And what it does is basically, I'm not a marine chemist, but I'll try and simplify it. All the carbon in the air that we put out there from my car that I drove up here today, and all the infrastructure that puts out combustion engines, etc., the ocean acquires it, absorbs the carbon, and about a quarter of the carbon that goes into the atmosphere is absorbed by the ocean. Now, the ocean is quite large, so it can take a lot.
Yeah, now explain how it absorbs, if you would.
Please. Certainly, yeah. Basically, what happens is carbonic acid is created. When carbon hits water, it mixes with hydrogen. There's ion, sort of what they call ion and non-ionic compounds that basically mix together in a balance between bicarbonate, carbonate, and carbonic acid. So you have a potential mix there. And when you have too much of something in a system, it creates an imbalance. And what happens is marine creatures that have shells, oysters, periwinkles, crabs, you name it, and corals, they depend on this important chemistry mix, this balance, this fine line, in order to make their skeletons and make their shells. So what happens is they produce things called polymorphs. And these polymorphs have compounds and structures called aragonite and silate. And basically, this is what helps the organisms make their skeletons. And when you have too much hydrogen ions in the sea created from the carbon, which has created the acid, it affects their balance and it actually dissolves their shells. And it affects them two ways, sort of externally in shell and dissolving their shells, and internally, I think the hypercapnia, I think, is the process they call, where you have too much CO2 in your blood system, in your bloodstream, and it affects your ability to procreate, to eat, to forage, your activities. So in the deep water environment where we'll be going, I'm very interested in storing carbon underneath the seabed as a sort of a solution to climate change, and instead of not letting the carbon get into the atmosphere. So what I'm very nervous about is that if you have, in deep water environments, there is, because there's no photosynthesis, there's no light getting down there, there's a large amount of, well, not a large amount, but there's more carbon stored down there. So if you have more stored in oil and gas wells that are no longer used or empty, which is a good mechanism and tried and tested, but if it leaks, and I must stress, if it leaks, you'll have an imbalance in deep water ecosystems, and the ocean will eventually regenerate this carbon into the atmosphere. Now, it could be hundreds of years, but the idea is to keep the carbon down there, keep it out of the atmosphere so it doesn't affect climate change.
Well, think of all the oceans in the world, how of all the seas, how could you possibly keep it down?
Well, what you do you is...
keep a little bit down,
no,
maybe.
No, it's not at the bottom of the sea.
I'm trying to figure out. I'm trying
it's
to understand
actually in the
it,
rocks
yeah.
beneath it.
Exactly. I'm talking a mile or two underneath the seabed. Mm-hmm. So you think where we get our oil and gas from. We get it from the North Sea. We get it, even off the coast of Cork not so long ago.
Mm-hmm. But it's from the rocks that are actually under the sea.
Absolutely. Yes. You can get oil and gas from geology formations, from saline aquifers and oil and gas wells that are now empty of oil and gas reserves. So what you do is, the infrastructure is already there, Derek. So what you do is you capture the carbon. Now, there's a couple of ways. I'm no engineer, but from my research tells me, there's a couple of ways to capture carbon. The way the energy that we've produced in power stations, it all releases carbon, whether it's peat, sustainable biofuels or whatever it all releases carbon. So they capture the carbon on site in a number of different mechanisms, and then they transport it to areas where it can be stored in geological structures, where it can be deep under the water or it can be on land. And this is where it's capped and stored. Now, research, this has been going on for in the oil and gas industry for a number of years, because they use mechanisms called enhanced oil recovery, where they pump gas into the actual empty oil and gas wells. And it actually, if you think, if you put pressure on one end, it's going to come out the other. So they get the residual amount of oil and gas that's in the actual the reserve. And what they do is then they cap it. Now, I think it was Statoil in the early 1990s did this in what's called the Stepner oil field, and it's proved very successful. But it is without doubt, it's one of the very important, what they call, solutions or mitigations to dealing with climate change. It's not going to be the whole be all and end all that will do it, because you need to work with low energy technologies, better energy efficiency, and low carbon technologies. So it's one of the portfolio of solutions.
What you're saying then is to take the actual carbon dioxide gas, put it into the hole that was formerly occupied by oil, and hold it there.
Yes.
But now we know that photosynthesis is the process whereby carbon dioxide is turned into carbon by plants growing.
Correct.
And we always think about it as the rainforest doing this. But our oceans cover 2/3 of our planet, and green algae live on the surface of our oceans. Now, our green algae will obviously carry out photosynthesis, take in carbon, have it in their bodies, and when they die, they sink to the bottom of the ocean and don't decompose.
That's
so
correct.
Surely isn't this the business? Grow lots of green algae, and when they die down, they'll go with the carbon and leave it down there.
Yeah, you're very right, Aina. I mean, there's two mechanisms here. Recent research in the States have suggested that if they farm algae, as you say, through photosynthesis, it holds onto carbon dioxide or carbon. And then you can use that farmed algae, bring it ashore, and even make a biofuel out of it. So there's an avenue there. But there's scientists have also suggested that we do iron fertilisation in the sea. So where you get a lot of iron powder, you put it into the sea, and the small animals called phytoplankton, which are marine organisms and plants, as you know, Aina, they hold, in order to grow, they hold all this carbon. And what they do is eventually, now this needs further research, it's not tried and tested 100%, but they keep all this carbon, and then through natural life cycles, they will perish and they will die, and they'll sink to the bottom of the ocean, and that's where the carbon they captured should stay. But as I said, it hasn't been fully tested, but the theory is correct, because plants, they hold on to carbon. So
it doesn't happen naturally. Because
hold your thoughts, if you would, because we've got to do a commercial break, and then news and sport. We're talking to Rowan Byrne, a marine biologist, and he's here to tell us about ocean acidification. Aina, you wanted to say something.
Yes, you were describing the whole process of how the ocean becomes acidified, and you were saying that the CO2 is dissolved in the ocean. Now, this presumably only happens at the interface between the ocean and the atmosphere. So what happens then? Is the acid that's formed heavier? Does it sink? Does it stay at the surface? Because you were saying the crabs and stuff are affected by it, but they're walking on the bottom, they're not at the top. So is there, you know, could you expand a little bit more on this?
Certainly. Well, I mean, the carbonic acid, or the equilibrium, where the ionic equilibrium that's disrupted, is pretty much universal across the ocean. It would be a big concern down in the deeper sort of abyssal zones at 3,000 metres plus, because the animals that live down there, the crabs, etc., and the starfish, they have a limited tolerance for variation in carbon, because carbon, obviously with no photosynthesis down there, there isn't that much sunlight, there's a lot more carbon down there, so any tip anything over their tipping point will affect them.
So it does sink down then, it forms at the surface and starts
absolutely
to move down through the water column.
I won't say it's universally distributed, but it's dissolved into the seawater. And you'll also find that current research is looking into the coastal effects of ocean acidification, because it happens in pretty much every realm. It's the unseen parts of the sea which we can't tell. That's why we're going on this expedition to have a look and see. But it predominantly can affect, in the deeper waters anyway, deep water coral. I mean, it's amazing to think that in a community structure, whether it's in coastal area or in deep water environments, if you have one element or one organism or one creature that's sort of out of sync, it has cascading effects in the whole ecosystem. I mean, recently discovered deep water corals in the early 2000s off Scotland, a place called Mingalay Reef. They found that there's an association of up to 1,300 species around this deep water coral. So if this deep water coral is, you know, suffering from ocean acidification, you're in big trouble.
Well. You know? So the green algae then that are growing and taking the carbon out of the atmosphere, why aren't they growing anyway? I mean, is the sea too poor to support them? You were talking about adding iron to the water.
Yeah.
I mean, is there a shortage of nutrients for these green algae?
It's a very fine balance as ever. Algae has a role to play naturally in the ecosystem. And I think research to date is very much gearing towards natural systems and how they work in the ocean. Because if you want to understand something, first you have to get its measure and then you can manage it. And I think what scientists are doing now is with green algae, with iron fertilisation and with carbon capture and storage, they're looking at ways that the natural system deals with these. I mean, one avenue that is really of interest is weathered, engineered weathering. And what they do is they take the sea. The sea, as we said, has a natural carbonic acid dissolved in it, but it has a weathering where this carbonic acid will capture the sort of the carbon and bring it down to the deeper waters. But if they replace some of that, that's a natural system. If they replace some of that with hydrochloric acid, it speeds it up. So what scientists have done is they've looked for the natural systems. How can they adapt or modify them? How can they learn from them rather than reinventing the wheel and not knowing the circumstances?
I've read that the oyster people who farm oysters have a kind of a weather forecast equivalent of carbon content of the water, because the baby oysters won't do well if the carbon content is high. So what they're actually doing is they're watching for a nice period of good weather, that is to say, low carbon content, and then they will release the eggs and they will get through the early difficult stages so that when things get bad again, they're through the worst part. Is this true?
Well, yeah, you'll find that Mother Nature has a way of predicting the weather. I mean, that does sound familiar to me about oysters. I mean, I can give you another example, but even though it's not ocean acidification as such, a couple of years ago, there was researchers who put small tags, home tags, I forget the name of them, on sharks, and they were tracking them around lagoons off the coast of Florida. And within a day or two of an oncoming hurricane, the sharks scarpered offshore. And they didn't realise what was going on. You know, why did the sharks leave until the hurricane came and there was electromagnetic interference in the water, and the sharks obviously said, we need to get out of here, there's coastal waves or storm coming, or, you know, they hypothesised, and then the sharks left. And then when the storm passed, the sharks came back in. And these are juvenile sharks who stay coastal anyway, small species. So along with your oysters and your sharks, Mother Nature has a way of telling us there's something en route, there's something not right, and when the conditions are right, then I'll behave
Same
accordingly.
Same for that tsunami all those years ago. I know there was a tsunami warning the other day, didn't the elephants or all this head for high ground?
Yes. Turtles did that as well.
As the people did the other day.
I should say the turtles didn't head for high ground, but they left the nesting beaches because during the nesting season, when the tsunami hit parts of Indonesia, etc., they couldn't really realise, where's the turtles gone? This is nesting season, we're at the peak. And for some strange reason, turtles didn't come ashore. And then after the tsunami, the earthquakes that happened, turtles started to come back. So Mother Nature has a way to sort of say, there's something coming if you pay attention, and if you don't...
So are they going to use these turtles now as early warning systems next time around?
You could do, but one event doesn't make it a complete hypothesis.
No, but if you think about it, I mean, if you think of the little Kemp's Ridley turtle, and that's on Rancho Nuevo, where that is true. I understand it breeds in only one stretch of beach in the world, which is Rancho Nuevo in the Gulf of Mexico.
That's true.
So all of a sudden, if they're not there one year, you would have to think, well, either they were all clobbered out at sea or there's something about to happen.
Well, this is it. I mean, as I was saying, with the oysters, with the sharks, with the turtles, the Mother Nature has a way to communicate to you that there's something not right. And of course, if all of Ridley's in the Gulf of Mexico start to disappear, then there's something really wrong, because that is the only location along that coastline that you'll find them.
So it's all very interesting. And certainly the oysters, you're saying, Richard, that the actual oyster farmers are looking at the forecast and not sending it. But
That's their way of dealing with this problem.
But in the natural world, I mean, would they be able to retain them, or is there a way of the oysters staying put for a while and then moving when the conditions are right for them?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say, but I mean, the one thing you have to remember about oysters and mussels and sort of coastal species, I mean, some of the ocean acidification research in Australia compared to species in Norway, they found that some shelled coastal creatures like oysters and mussels, depending on where they are, if they're in the intertidal zone where there's a natural fluctuation of pH and salinity, they handle things a little bit better. And even some of the oysters and mussels that were in sort of estuarine environments where there's a lot more fresh water, they were even better to deal with the pH. So you will find that ocean acidification and sort of Mother Nature itself, depending on where the species are located, they might have adapted their own mechanisms to deal with the variances in their environment.
So when you go out on this research vessel, what do you hope to do? What do you hope to achieve? And what will be done when you come back when all this research has been gathered? What happens? All this data has been gathered.
My primary interest, Eric, is carbon capture and storage and storing this carbon dioxide underneath the seabed. When it's capped and we keep all this carbon dioxide in the defunct oil and gas wells, which are now empty of oil and gas, if they leak, and I must stress, if they leak, the leaked carbon will have an effect in the deep sea environment. And as I said, there's a limited tolerance of variances in carbon dioxide at that level, or carbon. So I'll be investigating the effects of carbon dioxide on different deep sea species and being able to report back, you know, what happens if this animal is exposed to pressurised carbon dioxide at this atmospheric depth. So I'll be investigating basically the environmental impact of carbon on deep sea species if it was kept and is being kept in carbon capture and storage facilities.
Rowan, thank you very much indeed. You can email Mooney at rte.ie or text 51551.